You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, July 26, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow, the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ryan Grimm, Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post, on the latest in the debt deal, dueling speeches last night, bizarre speeches. Matt may have a contrary position to mine, but I thought the whole thing was bizarre. And if you watch it, I'm sure you thought it was bizarre, because that speech was for people who've been living under a rock. And you, the Majority Report listener, is part of an elite cadre of some of the most well-informed political observers in the country. And I say that without hesitation. You know, I start to listen to different podcasts that are out there. Is there a better political podcast that exists out there on a daily basis? I mean, yes, there's a couple of qualifications in there on a daily basis, hosted by me, I would also add. But seriously, this is a political junkie podcast. And as such, folks, I have been doing some extensive research on the existence of conservatives. Well, let me first tell you this story. This is sort of just stunning. So think progress. We also have it at courthousenews.com. A high school student in Arkansas was blocked from receiving sole valedictorian honors this summer despite earning the highest GPA in her class. That's generally the way they pick them, right? I mean, I guess if you had the highest GPA in class, and then maybe you did something like, threaten to blow up a bomb in the school, they wouldn't give you valedictorian. Or if you, had committed some crime and you were going to jail. Or if you lived in Arkansas and went to the McGee Secondary School, if you were black. School administrators worried that Kimberly Wimberly's, well, they may have had an issue with their name rhyming too, I guess. Kimberly Wimberly. They were worried that Wimberly's accomplishment would result in a, quote, big mess at the majority white school. So Principal Daryl Thompson told the student's mother that he decided to name a white student as co-valedictorian. Even though the white student had a lower GPA, the matter is currently pending in federal court. You ask yourself, how does this exist? How does this happen? Where do conservatives come from? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I believe I have the answer. Live science, is reporting that a new bit of research corroborates evidence to the theory that Neanderthals and humans interbred. Sometime after humans migrated out of Africa between 50,000 and 80,000 years ago. Well, that's a joke. There was no planet 50,000 or 80,000 years ago. We all know the planet is 6,000 to 10,000 years old. And of course, humans and Neanderthals couldn't have interbred because humans just showed up on day one. Hello? The DNA fragment found on the a human X chromosome is present in 9% of humans across the world, from Asia to Europe to America, except in Africa where it does not appear. It's in the Middle East, it's in Europe, it's in Eurasia, it's in America, it's in Australia, study researcher Damien Labuda of the University of Montreal. Oh, well, of course, this comes from Canada. They don't realize how old the world is. Aren't they all atheists in Canada? I don't know. This one event which led to this on the human X chromosome has to occur very early after modern man left Africa. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. When you wonder how it is that our country can be in the shape it is, when you look at the modern Republican Party, when you hear stories of some yahoo denying a high school student or a middle school student the valedictorian title, despite the fact that she earned it, because she's black, now you understand why. Because they have a problem on their X chromosome because they interbred with Neanderthals. There it is, folks. See if you get that from some other podcast. Good luck with it. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm, who is going to tell us the latest in the state of play in this debt ceiling deal. I'll also see if he agrees with my analysis of those two speeches last night. President Obama, 9 p.m. at night, giving a national speech to the nation, you know, where he walks down that red carpet. I can't remember what that's called. Is that called Chinese Man Theater? I don't know what that's called. I'll ask Ryan Grimm. We'll be right back after this.
So you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day it's fine, the next it's black. So if you want me off your back, well come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So come on and let me know. This indecision's bugging me. If you don't want me, set me free. Exactly whom I'm supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow?
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Good to be here, Sam.
Let's start with these speeches last night, because I was completely befuddled by these dual addresses by first President Obama. He came down that red carpet. What's that called? Is that Chinese Man Theater?
I believe so.
Okay, so he walks down the red carpet. He comes up to, and he is speaking as if to essentially an audience that has not been following this, it seems, at all. Is that an accurate assessment? I mean, both he and Bonaire seem to be talking about the, as if this has just sort of come up.
Yeah, Obama used the phrase, this thing called the debt ceiling. You know, most Americans have an opinion on whether and how it should be raised, but at least according to pollsters. But yeah, you're right on. Both of them talked to people like they were kids who just showed up for like Sunday school.
And so, and let me ask you this: President Obama came out and he was very much he embraced Boehner here. He specifically blamed. Essentially, he didn't name it, but the Tea Party caucus in the House. He said the words balanced approach six times over the course of whatever his 5 or 7 minute, 12 minute address. And what's he going for here?
Well, you know, it almost looks like and I hope this isn't the case, but it looks like he was setting up failure. You know, he was trying to make it clear to the American people that if this whole thing goes down, it's not his fault. Seems like he wants to sound like the reasonable guy. Look at what I've offered and balance. And they refuse to take it. And so, when this ship goes down, don't blame me. And in fact, there's going to be a guy on right after me. And, Boehner almost made his case for him.
Right. I mean, and he's responsible. But the one thing that sort of mystifies me on this, and it almost suggests to me that he may be making another speech, is that he came out and he kept talking about revenue increases, right? He wanted a balanced approach, revenue increases and cuts. But earlier in the day, Harry Reid came out with a proposal that had $2.7 trillion in cuts and no revenue increases. And the White House said that they could live with that. Why didn't he bring that up? I mean, is he basically keeping some of his powder dry to come back in 5 days and say, okay, today is the disaster day. We're willing to take $2.7 trillion in cuts, and they still say no?
Yeah, I really think that his speech only makes sense in the context of default. Because you're right. If the timeline doesn't make sense. In the morning, he says, yes, I'm okay with this deal. That would be all tax cuts, you know, all cuts, no revenues. And then in the evening, he goes back to pushing for this grand bargain. So it seems like that's what he's doing, that he's framing, you know, who gets blamed for this thing going down.
And, then Boehner came up. He didn't talk any specifics too. And basically just, he seemed to be talking to a completely different constituency. He's worried about a revolt in his own party, isn't he?
It seemed, you're exactly right. It's a strange thing to do, to go on national TV and talk to an entire nation when your only audience is the 80-some Tea Party folks in your caucus. Like, why not just meet them in the basement of the Capitol and speak directly to them? And I guess the answer to that is that he wants them to see that he's not BSing them behind closed doors, that this is the message that he's taking to the, you know, to the entire country. So, but you know, it was kind of a scary little talk that he gave, because it's hard to see how those two sides, you know, Obama then followed by Boehner, how in a couple of days those two are going to be reconciled. He really stuck a flag in the ground there.
Yeah, and he also broke the first rule of addressing the Tea Party on national TV. Aren't you supposed to speak into a camera to the right of the one that's actually filming you?
Yes, or above it, or you know, you definitely don't look directly into the camera. That was a bit strange.
That was the most disconcerting thing. I mean, he was talking to the Tea Party people, and he was looking almost directly into the camera. But now, is this a function of the fact that he came out with his plan, which is, which I want you to delineate the Reid plan and the Boehner plan for me. But my understanding is that was more or less rejected by the House Tea Party caucus.
Yeah, it was. They don't. It's not enough for them. They don't want a few trillion dollars in cuts and the promise of a vote on a constitutional amendment. Damn it, they want. You know, basically the whole government cut now, and they want their constitutional amendment to be part of the Constitution, you know, by next Tuesday. And so anything short of that, is something that they're going to reject, and they did reject it. And then, you know, Reid comes back with this, here's your $2.7 trillion in cuts, a $2.5 trillion increase in the debt ceiling. It's everything you've asked for. And they're, you know, so they're in the position of looking crazy for not taking it. Now, there's one spot where Boehner seems to have blundered, and that's starting to become more apparent today. By constantly dogging the president for not leading and saying, look, we're leaders. We're the ones that are presenting plans. That means that he has to go forward with his plan. And so Wednesday and Thursday, there are going to be votes in the House on the House plan. And because he has to do this, because he, you know, has put so many marbles in this bag of I'm the leader. Then it goes over to the Senate where it gets squashed. Then Reid passes his reasonable-looking legislation, and then it's up to the House to either pass it or not pass it. And that puts all the onus on the House. And in Washington, the last bill standing is the one that usually becomes law. And so Boehner, by his bragging about how he's the leader, has been forced to lead. And the people that are behind him are the ones that are probably going to be able to push their bill over the finish line. So, you know, he kind of screwed himself here by getting too far out in front of the process.
Okay.
At least that's how it looks now. It's impossible to say what's going to happen.
Right.
It's total
right.
chaos. But that's the way it seems to be sifting out today.
All right. I want to break down the actual two different plans, because there's some very subtle differences when you look at it from afar. But as you get closer, they're pretty significant differences. But basically, what you're saying is that because this is sort of like the reverse of the tic tac toe I play with my daughter. In this case, because he goes first. It's going to be back on the House. At the end of the day, it's going to be back on the House to reject or accept a bill that could come out of the Senate, which would be Harry Reid's bill. And if the House, basically, they'll take the last vote before default. Is that basically what it comes down to?
Yeah, and that's the position that if you're Reid, that you want to be in. And Reid, for all you can say about him, is a master legislative and parliamentary tactician. And he seems to have outmaneuvered Boehner on this one.
Well, I mean, to be fair, we don't
know. And McConnell. He had McConnell's help, too.
Right. Well, to be fair, we don't know if Boehner has been sober the whole way. And we can only imagine if Boehner was sober, he might be doing a little bit better. So I don't want to make any judgment here on anybody. But let's
fair enough.
Break down for me Harry Reid's plan. It's $2.7 trillion of cuts. Where do the cuts come from?
Most of the cuts do not come from Social Security or Medicare or other entitlement programs.
Or Medicaid, right? Or Medicaid.
Or Medicaid, right. And they come from discretionary spending. You know, they nickel and dime their way to getting to a trillion some dollars. Then they factor in a certain amount of interest saved by not having spent those nickels and dimes.
About 400 billion.
Something minus. Like that. And then they factor in what, about a trillion or so in savings from going to war a little bit less over the next decade.
Right.
And so with that, you get to $2.7 trillion.
Okay. So you got a trillion predicated on the ending of Afghanistan and Iraq wars.
Mm-hmm.
You've got $400 billion off of the savings on interest because you're not borrowing the money. And then another 1.3 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Comes from $300 billion comes from cutting out fraud. I don't know why we've been doing the whole fraud thing. That should never be a line item in any budget, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, but you have a fraud lobby that is very strong in Washington. So
one of them became governor of Florida, is my understanding.
That's right.
But okay, so we cut that out, and then he also has, and you were one of the first, if not the first, to report on this. He has the inclusion of the Super Congress, but it's slightly different than Boehner's Super Congress. Break down Reid's Super Congress.
Right, both have a Super Congress, and both would work in similar ways, where you'd have 12 member bicameral body, where you've got six. Votes from the Senate, six from the House, six Democrats, six Republicans, and you would need seven votes for them to pass legislation. That legislation would then be rammed through Congress, fast-tracked in a matter of days, It couldn't be amended up or down. It could just be voted on. You know, and once you've got the leaderships behind this, it's a fait accompli.
My understanding is that there's no filibustering this either, right, in the Senate?
Right. Okay. Exactly. All of a sudden, all the arguments that you've been hearing about the filibuster and Senate traditions and whatever have you, they don't apply anymore. Now there's a key difference between...
Now, wait a second. Let me clarify one more thing, too. When you talk about legislation, you're essentially talking about cuts. And a lot of people are concerned, and the idea is that these cuts, they could be Social Security, they could be Medicare, they could be Medicaid, they could be anything, essentially, and they are not subject to a filibuster. They are they're not subject to amendments, and it really is, there are two important elements. One is who sits on that this high commission of super Congress. And then the other part, the difference between Reid and Boehner's plan is
Boehner's would be tied to default. Now, Reid would extend the debt ceiling past the election so that you wouldn't have to monkey around with this debate again. Boehner, however, would only authorize about $1 trillion slightly and change increase in the debt ceiling, which means it's say 6 months-ish, sometime after that, a year from now, we'd have to come back to this debate. And the only way the Congress could vote on raising the debt ceiling again is if they first passed the recommendation, the legislation, not recommendations, the legislation that comes from this super Congress. So it would be this hostage situation just, you know, magnified exponentially. If you don't pass this, not only do you have to have a fast-track vote, not only can you not filibuster it, not only can you not amend it, but if you don't pass it, you can't raise the debt ceiling.
That's a massive, massive difference. I mean, one is that there's a tremendous, in the Boehner plan, there's a lot of leverage here to pass this thing. Not only is the threshold lower, but there's a tremendous amount of leverage on the Boehner thing. On Reid's proposal, there is no leverage, and so they could say we're going to cut X, Y, or Z, but you need just basically an up or down vote to quash this thing in the Senate.
Or you would need all six Democrats
right.
on the Super Congress to right. just refuse to do anything. If they did that in the Boehner situation, then default would be the result. In the Reid situation, it would just be a bunch of wasted meetings and just stale Chinese food.
Right. Okay. So that's a big difference. And despite that fact, the Republican Boehner's caucus has rejected it.
Right. They said that commissions like this in the past have been vehicles that have been used to raise taxes. The Greenspan commission back in 1983 extended the life of Social Security by, you know, making some tweaks and raising some taxes here and there is, I guess, something that they don't like. That's an example of something that didn't work for them because it involved some tiny amount of tax increases. So, yeah, to them, this isn't good enough. And you know, some Tea Party members certainly have some reservations about creating this this super legislative body that. Because, you know, they talked a huge game in 2009 and 2010 about closed-door meetings and democracy.
SARS, right? I mean,
all
you need to do is call this super Congress the super czar Congress or something, and
right.
then it's the poison pill. Oh, I lost him. We'll call him. Sorry. Sometimes we have technical difficulties.
It happens.
Yeah.
Wasn't my fault, but it happens.
No. The real question is, will he answer his phone? Keep the volume up so I can hear this. Let's just...
Hello?
Hi, there sorry. We had a little bit of technical difficulties on our end.
Yep.
So you could call it the Super Tsar Congress, and that's the poison pill. It can never exist. But wait, let me ask you this, all right? Because I consider myself someone who is not in any way hesitant to classify... Republicans and particularly Tea Party people as completely batshit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I, even with that understanding, I do not understand why they are rejecting the Boehner plan. Because, you know, You can look back at that Greenspan Commission. All they did was essentially raise taxes on, not on poor people, but on poor people and middle class people. And they could always reject this. They have the majority in the House. If this Super Tsar Commission came up with this, what is their end game here? I mean, are we at the point now where there is absolutely no cohesion on the Republican side whatsoever? I mean, there is no bullying. There is nothing. It's simply every man for himself at this point.
Yeah, I was talking to a top House Republican aide very early in this Congress, and he said something that stuck with me. That was that he said, you know, we're in a position where we can get tremendous and unprecedented concessions from Democrats. We can see it before us. So the question for us is, are we going to be able to persuade our freshmen to take them? And that's always been the tension. I think part of what's happening is that these freshman Republicans have really bought the lines that the Republicans in Washington have been using for years. They've really internalized that the elites in Washington lie to you, that the game is rigged, that you can't make a difference, that this is the way that Washington works, et cetera, et cetera. And they showed that early on when they rejected the leadership's Patriot Act vote, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
They were told, look, this is just three little provisions of it. It's just a three-month extension. Please, we need this. It's a really big deal. Just trust us. And the freshmen said, no, we don't trust you. So they've really internalized this distrust of institutions that the Republicans have been preaching for a couple of decades now. And it's coming home to roost now in that Boehner and Cantor and McCarthy are saying, look, this is an amazing deal. You're not going to get anything better than this. And they're like, we don't believe you.
It's like they all have rabies. It's like literally you have a rabid raccoon. You put a plate of food in front of it and it just sort of like thinks it's poop. I mean, it's bizarre. No. Well, let me ask you this, and because that's the to me the most underreported story here is that this is not unlike what happened with immigration. I think, 4 years ago now, where the sort of the electoral of the lies and the red meat they'd been feeding their electoral base, they've created these Frankensteins, and they're even less sort of like. Coherent than Frankenstein in some respects, but where does anybody know where the Republican presidential hopefuls are on this?
They seem to have as much respect. The freshmen have as much respect for these presidential hopefuls as they have for their leadership, which is very, very little. There's little incentive for these candidates to weigh in here.
Have they been pressed on it? I mean, it seems this would be the number one. I mean, this is the most relevant thing for these guys, right? I mean, is there going to be a default? I mean, what's going to happen presumably in a year if you're president, or a year and a half if you're president, and this debt ceiling thing comes up?
Well, Bachman has been pressed on it, and she's she's in the House, so we'll weigh in on it. And she has said that she'd vote against it basically no matter what. So she's, staking it out on the far right. I don't know what a President Bachman would do if she had to raise the debt ceiling.
She'd just go ahead and do it, and we'd all pretend like this never happened.
Right, exactly. The others have taken extreme positions, but, with an out where they say that, they'd like, they want these types of cuts, et cetera. They're not at the table and they don't have to vote. So it's kind of an easier situation for them to be in. Because they know that what they say doesn't have much consequence.
Interesting.
And all these folks see themselves as the next president and, know that they'll have to deal with this.
They don't want to foreclose their opportunity to get a clean debt ceiling vote.
Right.
All right. So what else? I mean, where do you think this goes? I mean, is your sense that there's not going to be a deal at all?
I mean, there is a very strong possibility that there's no deal. I think that the administration in that case would find some way to avoid default. I don't know how, you know, they've ruled out the 14th Amendment so many times, it'd be hard for them to do that, but, you know, the Times had an op-ed from some legal scholars the other day saying that you could just cite the necessary clause, in there, the same way that, Lincoln, who is, you know, Obama's hero, did with, suspending habeas corpus. But I think that there is a decent chance that, the House will pass or the House won't pass. Like, there's a chance that Boehner will lose the vote because Democrats are gonna, rally against this.
Right.
And if Boehner loses enough members of his own conference, he could actually not get his thing through the House. At which point Reid and McConnell can just run the table on him. But even if he does get it through, the Senate will then quickly squash it. Then the Senate, with McConnell's help, will pass, this $2.7 trillion in cuts thing. And then it'll be up to the House. And that'll be Boehner's moment where he has to decide, do I want to put this on the floor and try to pass it with Democrats and Republicans working together, or do I want to keep it from the floor? Now, what he could do is put it on the floor, say that this is the Democratic thing to do. I'm voting against this. I think this is terrible, but I'm going to put it on the floor and then allow, you know, his folks behind the scenes to try to whip up, you know, say 100, 110 Republican votes and 100, 110 Democratic votes, and then you've got it, and then he hopes that there's no revolt in his conference over that.
I mean, if he puts it on the floor, he is done as Speaker of the House, isn't he? I mean, will there not?
I don't. Yeah.
Isn't that Cantor's wet dream right there? I mean, isn't that what he's waiting for? The bill goes from the Senate, the McConnell or the Reid bill with McConnell's blessing goes from the Senate to the House. And Boehner says, I'll put it on the floor, I'll put it up to a vote, I'm going to vote against it, and all of the Tea Party caucus votes against it. Some of the moderate Republicans, if there are any, I don't know if there are any enough, basically, to join with the Democrats to pass it. It passes, and Cantor basically becomes Speaker.
There's a scenario that, you know, the one you laid out is plausible. It's also possible that the freshman would realize that they don't have it, and they can't overthrow him. But there's no shortage of members of his conference who are, would be happy to see that happen. But there are others who recognize the value of having, Boehner up there. And maybe they'll let him stay there for a while, before throwing him overboard. It's hard to say.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, and that's Boehner's huge problem that he's facing.
One final question for you on the 14th Amendment. Has the Office of Legal Counsel weighed in on this? I know that we've heard from Geithner. I know that we've heard from the administration. But has the Office of Legal Counsel weighed in? Because it ultimately, that would be the fig leaf if Obama had to come on TV again, walk down the red carpet and say, look, we've tried everything. It hasn't passed. And the Justice Department has told me that it is my obligation constitutionally, as I'm not making a choice here, it's my obligation constitutionally,
right,
to invoke the 14th Amendment, fourth clause of the 14th Amendment, and I have to do this.
You know, I think that the closer it gets to collapse, the more likely something like that is. He said in College Park the other day, asked about this, and he gets asked about it wherever he goes. He said, our people have looked into it, which I assume means Office of Legal Counsel, but they haven't commented one way or another on whether or not the OLC has actually drafted a memo or what. He said, you know, my folks don't think that's a winning argument, I think was his phrase. But it's not an argument.
Right.
It's a power struggle. You know, he lays it down. He says, I'm doing this. The professors can go ahead and argue it out. He'll have experts on his side. They'll have experts on their side. It then becomes a power struggle over whether they want to actually try to impeach the president over paying bills. And I think that's a political argument that he wins hands down.
Right. I agree with that. All right. Well, Ryan Grimm, thank you so much. I know I kept you longer than I said I would, but I appreciate it. It's
my pleasure.
This is one of the most bizarre periods of politics in years and years, as far as I can tell. It is so strange. Yep. So strange. Yep. And
the whole thing's made up.
It is just bizarre. It is like it's just layers and layers of theater, and I don't know what to make of it. Ryan Grimm, yep. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Talk to you later.
All right. We got to take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back. Plenty more news to report to you. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I think I mentioned this yesterday, but it bears repeating. Did I say this in the post show yesterday? You had hundreds of gay couples in New York State got married yesterday.
Yeah, we spoke about it.
We did speak about it.
Very briefly, but we spoke about it.
Well, there you go. And I will add that it is just breaking. Just breaking. I had it right in front of me, but I don't at the moment, but I'll have to do this from memory. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman of New York. Wait a second. Here it is. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman this morning filed a friend of the court brief challenging the legality of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And this is basically just weighing in. New York State now allows full rights for all of its citizens, even if you're gay. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Even if you're gay, you have full rights. Oh, what will they think of next? Even if you're gay, you get to be a full citizen of the United States. Gosh, soon all you got to do is show up and say, I'm a toaster, and then you're a full citizen of the United States. So he has filed a friend of the court brief in the federal court case that you know that the Obama administration is not defending DOMA in that case. So it'll be interesting to see if that how that federal court rules. For DOMA. Let's go. Oh, what are you looking at? Are you getting? Oh, should we do this? Yeah.
I thought we should make sure we have it on the
let's
show.
Let's do it. This is Glenn Beck. You know, here's the thing. When you move off of television and you're in a locked sort of a dungeon like he is with his Glenn Beck show now on TV, it's web. I don't know if you can get any of it for free. I don't think so. I think you have to be a member to get any of it. This is not as democratic as this.
Well, it's Glenn Beck.
It's Glenn Beck. Now, of course, he's on radio, but what this guy has to do now is he's going to have to get even more spectacularly offensive and retarded. And, folks, when I say the word retarded, I'm not talking about the mentally challenged people. I am talking about a guy who is, you know, walks around in the body of a 45-year-old, and he's retarded. I'm talking in the most colloquial sense. This is Glenn Beck on the shooting that took place in Oslo by this right-wing fanatic who shares many, if not 100%, of Glenn Beck's intellectual infrastructure. They both draw from the exact same well. But Glenn Beck manages to slag the camp, the youth camp for future leaders of the Labor Party. And here he does. Here it is.
So, Saturday, I was following the news of the shooting in Norway and the explosion in Norway, which happened, what, on Friday?
Yeah, the explosion was, and then we left the air, and
right,
and then he went to you know, the camp.
Yeah, well, when we heard the explosion, everybody was willing to say, it's Muslim extremists! It's Muslim extremists! I don't think we made a comment on it because we didn't know, other than there was a bombing that happened. And as the thing started to unfold, and then there was a shooting at a political camp, which sounds a little like, you know, the Hitler Youth or whatever. I mean, who does a camp for kids that's all about politics? Disturbing. But anyways.
Who does a camp for kids? It is all about politics. Disturbing. June 13th, 2011, from the Tampa Times. Here's another option of how the kids, now that the kids are out of school, a week-long seminar about our nation's founding principles, courtesy of the Tampa 912 Project. 912.
It's not 9/11. That's the day before.
No, right. 9/11 is the day before. What happened on the day after? Oh, it was 9/12. What am I thinking of? It reminds me of, oh, that guy we were just listening to.
Yeah.
9/12. That's Glenn Beck's organization.
I remember now.
Yes, of course. The organization, which falls under the Tea Party umbrella, hopes to introduce kids ages 8 to 12 to principles that include America is good, I believe in God, Macht Frau. What is it? I work hard for what I have, and I will share it with who I want to. Government cannot force me to be charitable.
Hey, what happened?
Well, I'll be. Is Glenn Beck saying that his 9/12 Project camp is actually like the Hitler Youth? Let me try that again. Like the Hitler Youth? I guess so. Moving on. What an idiot he is.
He attacks the children who died, the kids who died.
Of course he does. What a just a horrible human being. But, you know, you gotta, if you want to make it, you want to make it in this online business, folks. That's what it's going to take. This brief story, and then we will go to our post show. New York Times has a very disturbing story. Look, you know, I go on these shows. I was on yesterday on Radigan's show saying the same thing I said to Tim to Pataki. I was saying the same thing to Tim Carney. There is a crisis in this country. It is called 9.2% unemployment. And what makes this a crisis, a growing crisis, even if the numbers don't move, is the length of time people are out of work. It begins to deteriorate the workforce. It begins to create incredible and more stress. People run out of their savings. They run out of their health insurance. They and their skills begin to atrophy, or they become less hireable. And at the very least, we now have anecdotal, if not evidence. Maybe it's not even anecdotal evidence. Now it's evidence that is out in the open. New York Times, a recent review of job vacancy postings on popular sites like Monster.com, CareerBuilder, and Craigslist revealed hundreds that said employers would consider or at least strongly prefer only people currently employed or just recently laid off. And this is to be expected. Economists are aware of this. Everyone who is involved in employment issues are completely aware of this. This is another element as to why 9.2% unemployment is a crisis, is an emergency. And it's one that is not only being dealt with, not only not being dealt with by both Republicans and Democrats. And yes, it's true, Republicans, this is their number one job, is to keep Americans from getting jobs. New York Times came out with it today in their editorial. It is absolutely unequivocally clear that the Republicans' main agenda is to break government down and prevent it from doing anything to help people. In fact, that's their stated goal. What did Bonaire say last night? The bigger government is, the smaller the people. aside from the fact that I don't know what the fuck that's supposed to mean. That is their number one agenda. Keep government from doing its job to help Americans get jobs. That is their number one agenda. And this story is just one more indication as to why this crisis grows, even if the unemployment numbers don't. Legal experts say that the practice probably does not violate discrimination laws because unemployment is not a protected status. The Equal Unemployment Opportunity Commission recently held a hearing, though, on whether discriminating against jobless might be illegal because it disproportionately hurts older people and blacks who are more likely to have a job loss. They will probably not be able to circle that square. The practice is common enough that New Jersey recently passed a law outlawing job ads that bar unemployed workers from applying. New York and Michigan are considering the same idea, but that's not going to make a difference. Because employers are less likely to hire you if you've been out of work for an extended period of time. The average duration of unemployment today is 9 months. It's a record high. It is a record high. It's virtually impossible to prove that people are doing this, but now they're doing it out in the open. Skills may atrophy, particularly in dynamic industry like technology. They may lose touch with their network of contacts. If you're a salesperson, that's, of course, key. Not to mention that after 12 months, 16 months, 10 months of looking for a job, you're completely demoralized. It's very hard to go into a job interview knowing, like, I desperately need this job. Very hard to do it when you've been rejected by so many people. Very hard to do it when you just haven't been able to get into job interviews, because once you hit a certain point, they're less likely to bring you in. They just call you out. This is why there is a crisis. And it's just stunning. That's what's so bizarre about this debt ceiling fight. It's completely kabuki theater. Unfortunately, the Democrats, at least President Obama, has bought into it as a way to supposedly get it off the table for electoral reasons. Meanwhile, for some reason, there has been a calculation that getting up there in front of the American people and saying we have to do everything we can to get jobs and fighting the Republicans on that, because the Republicans want to do nothing that promotes jobs. They want this economy to tank. They're willing to tank it because of their calculation. It will benefit them politically. And nothing's being done. All right, folks. Now we're headed to the flip side. Oh, wait a second. It's Mark Maron calling. Hold on for 1 second.
Yeah, what happened?
Yeah, let me, what's the number? I'll call you back. Yeah. Say the last four digits again. Okay, I'll call you in just 1 minute. All right, folks, we're heading to the post show. You can IM me at Majority FM. Oh, let me get my IM machine on. That was Mark Maron. I did his show last night, WTF. I will talk about that in the program, but I'm going to talk about it with Maron. He called a little bit late. He thought the show was over. Nice try, Maron. Nice try. Says he's walking. Folks, please become a member. Not only will I be talking about stories today, but I guess I'll be talking to Mark Maron on the phone. I'll be taking your IMs. I'll be taking your phone calls. We've got a lot of calls. We've been getting a lot of calls. So stick around. I'm going to call Maron just now. Please become a member. Also, don't forget to buy your junk through Amazon. You buy it through Amazon, use our link. And also buy your coffee from justcoffee.coop. coffee, tea, chocolate. If you haven't tried it, you're making a huge, huge mistake. Huge mistake. Do yourself a favor. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. And you get a 10% discount. We'll be right back. Mark Maron.